here we are. This is Sex, Love, Psychedelics, and I'm your host, Dr. Kat, bringing you psychosexual conversations that will leave you intellectually turned on and hungry for more. Hey, lovers. So our guest today, Nate, wrote this book called Open, which we're going to get into today. And I promise you that in the first few pages, you will see yourself and it might not feel good to admit it. Basically, we live in a world where there is, in so many ways, designed to direct our mind, our opinions, our emotions in a specific direction. And if we're not aware of how many of the very things that we use every single day are influencing our experience, then we are unconsciously giving up our power and closing our minds to the reality that there are many realities that coexist. Open-mindedness. Seems like a simple enough concept until you see the bigger picture. And then you get into the question of, am I actually open? Or am I identifying as someone who is open? And can I recognize the places where I am closed if I'm over-identifying my whole self-being as being open-minded? That is the master level question right there. Where am I closed? Not am I closed? Psychedelics and ketamine therapies are powerful ways to support the opening of the mind. But is there such a thing as being too open? And that's what we're getting into here today with Nate Klimp. But before we get to Nate, this coming May 2024, I'm going to be leading Exhale, which is a femme ketamine retreat here in Malibu, California. I'm sure you've heard so many different things about ketamine, that it's a rave drug, that it's, you know, causing a lot of turmoil and not know, right? I'm not going to say that that's not happening in the world. But what I will also share, and what we're going to get into with Nate today, is how beautiful this medicine is when it's held in a therapeutic container, when it's held with sacred reverence, with intention, and with medical care. Like, yes, it will change the experience from being at your friend's party on the couch going into a K-hole and the experience of being held and supported in introspection, curiosity, deepening, and exploring. So what ketamine can do for us is help us to lift the heaviness of the depression or the anxiety so that we can meet the parts of ourselves without dysregulation. We can access reference points of surrender. We can feel what it's like to soften in the body and to, again, when held with safety in a container, recognize what it's like to finally feel safe in our bodies. This is invaluable because once we can experience these states, once we can have clarity, then we can have something to work towards, to return back to. That's the work I do. Not only holding a strong, attentive, powerful container, but also supporting you on either side in preparation, getting you to develop the relationship and begin the relationship with your body, your inner parts, your emotions, but then also to support you on the other side to integrate this, to make sense of it, and to make a lasting plan of action. So if you want to hear about the experiences that I had personally or what it's like for ketamine therapy, then check out my podcast episodes about this exact thing. I would love for you to be a part of this upcoming retreat Exhale with us. This is 4 days of deep dives, somatic practices, integration, and continuing community. I'm including the link to the landing page and the application page in the show notes. Please, if you feel a ping, if you feel titillated, if you feel the curiosity rising in you, reach out. I would love to hop on to a call. Let's talk about it. Let's Google about it. Let's see what's up. Let's see what you're working on and if this would be a right fit. Now to my guest, Nate Klemp, who is a writer, a philosopher, and an entrepreneur. Woo! That stuck in my mouth. He's the author of this new book, Open, Living with an Expansive Mind in a Destructive World, which is really great. I'm just going to put that out there. Nate, I loved the book. I read it front to cover. He's also the co-author of the New York Times Editor's Choice, The 80-80 Marriage, a new model for a happier, stronger marriage, and the New York Times bestseller, Start Here, Master the Lifelong Habit of Well-Being. I'm so stoked to have you on the show, Nate. Welcome.
Pat, it's so good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. You know, before we pushed record, I was sharing with you that this over the past week, before I started reading your book, I was having multiple conversations with people about the concept of openness, even like, and I don't even know, it's just the synchronicity of life. And it's like, here, to prepare for this podcast, we're going to bring you these people. And primarily, we were talking about this concept of cancel culture in our society and how it's really created this fragility in our cultural landscape of like the inability for us to be authentic with our opinions or our ideas, and how there's a struggle with being able to allow somebody to have their own opinion and exist beside of us. And now it's like we have to exile them, we have to change them, or we have to cut them off, unfollow them, push them out of our lives so that we can stay comfortable in our own echo chamber. But then it also creates like fear for people to actually speak up or speak against or to say what's actually on their minds. And I don't know, this is something that you've seen, if this is what inspired you to write this open book, like what helped me to see your perspective of that?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. You know, in the way I see the world, there's this kind of like atmosphere of closure that's baked into the zeitgeist of our current time.
Yeah.
Which I think is what you're expressing.
100%.
And cancel culture is one manifestation of that. Screen addiction is another manifestation of that.
Ooh.
But I think what's interesting about the cancellation piece is that underneath all of that, there's like this aversion to engaging directly with people who disagree with you, right? So the way I experience it is, and you know, I think we all have this tendency to some degree, but it's like, there's no way I can engage with that point of view, or there's no way I can talk to that person who votes for that candidate, right? And we all have our own idiosyncratic starting point, whether we're on the left or the right. But what I think is really tragic about that outlook is that like there's so much to be gained for engaging with people who do disagree with you and who might not have the same friends, might not have the same values, the same social group. And so that was one of the things I actually set out to do in this book. I ended up spending time with the National Rifle Association, which is not my political home base. I live in Boulder, Colorado. I'm kind of a left of center type of guy. But I think there's something we're missing there. And so there's a real opportunity, I think, in that practice of opening to people who might disagree with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think it is that causes us to be able to, or causes that inability to sit with these two seemingly opposite beliefs or realities and allowing that to coexist?
Yeah, I mean, I think like there's definitely nothing new here. There's probably always been this aversion to opening up to the other side. But what is new, I think, is like the degree to which we have sort of segregated ourselves into communities of likeness. Mm. So we tend to live near people who think like us. We tend to hang out with people who think like us. And, you know, the statistics are really interesting that in 1980, Gallup did a survey. They found 47% of people in America felt warm and favorable toward the opposite party. Mm-hmm. They did that survey again in 2020. That number fell to 25%. So basically in half. And then there have been these other studies where they found 20% of Republicans and Democrats think the other side lacks the basic traits to be human, that they behave like animals, mm-hmm. and that we'd be better off if the other side just simply died.
Yeah.
Right. Like 20%. That's a crazy number of people.
Yeah.
So that's the context. And I think like there are probably a lot of reasons for that change. But if we're going to look at the key drivers, one of them has to be the rise of algorithmic media, mm-hmm. of social media, the ability that we now have to basically totally curate our information environment. So mm-hmm. that everything we see is like perfectly aligned with what we believe in. And to your point, the moment we encounter something that challenges us, we say, I got to unfollow that. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't have that around. Mm-hmm. And we used to live in an information environment that was a little bit more monolithic, where we didn't have as much choice and the ability to customize what we see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were being programmed
exactly.
by our immediate environment, by our family of origin, by, you know, our neighborhood. Yeah, I think of that too, like just this metaphor of our brains being like computers, and we really are made up of everything that we've experienced in our lives. And we see things through, you know, without contemplation, without challenging this program, right? We automatically see things through the lens of what we've experienced in ourselves or around us, or we've heard. And so if this algorithm is increasing, you know, the same message, the same people, the same reference points, yeah, it's going to feel very true, very real for us. And the number of people, so as we relate this to, you know, sex and relationships, it's like, I have conversations with people around, you know, these traditional ideas of relationships or sexuality. And often I will come up against people who are very strongly like, you know, think that I'm the devil for presenting some of these, you know, alternative ways of thinking and feeling and having sex. And so it's so fascinating to see how quickly that happens, you know, across the board with any of these things.
Well, and you're pointing toward something that I think is so important, which I would call it something like awareness, that there are like two ways of experiencing our reality. One is where we're just kind of living in this trance-like autopilot state, where we've been conditioned with certain ideas, certain values. Our mind is spinning, creating all sorts of stories about the past and future. And we're basically not taking a step back to look reflectively at any of it. We're just kind of like following the flow of habit. And that to me is another way of describing the state of closure that I think is so interesting. Because if you think about that state, like it's a pretty small life or small reality when that's how you're living. And not to say it's bad, but it's just the possibilities are pretty limited. Like the range of options for how to live, for how to have sex, for how to do whatever you're trying to do in your life, be creative, are pretty small. So what I think is really interesting is like, how do we use simple shifts of awareness to create a bigger, more expansive view of life? And I think like we're living in this crazy age where there's so many tools and technologies that are basically designed to do just that. Psychedelic assisted therapy, various forms of meditation, even that practice I talked about earlier, like going and hanging out with your political enemy, that will radically shift your worldview and your mental state. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm totally with you. And I think like that shift from just trance-like autopilot to awareness is so powerful and so essential, especially as the world seems to just get more and more chaotic and crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. And I, you know, had this moment too last night where I was sitting at a table having dinner with somebody that I wouldn't traditionally, like they're not in my circle, but I met them. I found them fascinating. So we got together and he was sharing with me about many different opinions that are outside of what I, you know, is traditionally surround myself. And I found myself so curious and asking questions and wanting to understand his excitement around this, around these topics. And curiosity is one of those that I think can be challenging for many people to access or not know how to be curious, or people identify as being curious, but they're not. Mm. And so how might people, you know, openness, curiosity, I think some of those are the qualities on the big five personality tests or, you know, inventories, you know, things like that, which would suggest that these are fixed traits. But you, what you're saying is we can train ourselves to be open, to be, you know, curious. How would you suggest people start that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the big five personality traits in psychology, we know the first one, introversion versus extroversion. Mm-hmm. The last one, which often isn't talked about, is openness versus closeness to experience. So
yeah,
I think that's important to bring up, just to say this is not some crazy woo-woo new age concept.
Right.
This is actually baked into the foundations of modern psychology. So, and to your point, it's a trait, which most of the time we think of traits in psychology as being fixed once we get to around the age of 30. Mm-hmm. So then the question becomes, well, how can we actually change ourselves at the level of trait? And I think what's really cool is that we now know that that is possible using various technologies. So one piece of this, which I know you're very interested in, is psychedelic assisted therapy.
Yeah.
Roland Griffiths and his lab, they did this really interesting study where they actually were measuring levels of openness before and after a high dose psilocybin guided journey. Mm-hmm. And they found that after the fact, levels of openness changed pretty radically, which in some ways isn't that surprising. Mm-hmm. What was really surprising is they went back to these people a year later and they found that this shift in openness, in this trait of personality, mm-hmm. was actually lasting a year after one high-dose psilocybin journey. So I think that's really interesting. And that says, okay, well, something like that modality can be really powerful. And then in the realm of practices like meditation, you know, which is not as extreme and intense in the moment as something like psychedelic assisted therapy, but it's I think of it as like building the habit of openness over time, almost like the strengthening and conditioning program for openness. There too, you're starting to see research saying like the changes that are occurring in mindset, the changes that are occurring in the brain, they're happening at that level of trait. So we actually do have the ability to start to sort of like have a little more freedom and a little more flexibility around mm-hmm. even our own personality traits, mm-hmm. which I think is really exciting.
It's exciting. It's really important for us to acknowledge too, so that we don't over-identify with these traits, because A, we're humans that are dynamic and we change throughout the day. You know, my level of openness may be more available to me in the afternoon than it is in the early morning or vice versa, you know? And, but then also like, you know, the pliability of our brain reminds us that we can change.
Yeah, I love the point you make about like the variability throughout the day.
Yeah.
It's funny writing a book on openness and then being in this process where I'm like talking to a lot of people, doing a lot of events, promoting mm-hmm. the book or whatever. I can just feel how like the practice of doing all the speaking and, you know, marketing and all of that is itself a practice of openness. And that there are these moments where I feel really closed down and like, what am I doing? Why did I write this book? Like, why am I doing this? And then other moments where things get really expansive. And to me, the practice boils down to like trying to just stay open to all of it, you know, and not favoring those moments where it feels really expansive and blissful. Cause like, that's, I think just this baked in tendency, at least in me, is to think like really blissful, pleasurable moments are good. The hard moments where there's a lot of self-doubt, a lot of sadness, a lot of fear, those are bad. I need to have less of those, more of the bliss. Mm-hmm. And so my practice has really just been like, all right, I'm just going to sit with whatever's arising. And right now what's arising is like afternoon anxiety. So, okay, let's see what that has to teach me.
Yeah, to teach you. There's information there.
For sure.
In my last episode, I did an interview with Dr. Ido Cohen, and we were talking about the concept of integration from psychedelics and the importance of the wholeness. you know, and not dissociating from those moments that are boring or that are anxiety provoking or that are, you know, have these different emotions, because there's information there. And that's really important to be with and be in curiosity to lean in towards, like, what's here?
Yeah, I think that was a lesson I definitely learned through psychedelic assisted therapy. So I actually wasn't planning to write about psychedelics in this book, and I wasn't planning to take psychedelics, but I started to just see all these amazing advances in psychedelic research and started to think it would be very difficult to write a book about opening without having something to say or having some experience of what's happening there. And so I had a number of really interesting experiences. But one of the more interesting ones was after I had had this just amazing psychedelic assisted session, I came back for another one and I was just ready to have like this like total unlocking, like amazing emotional release in the session. And it was terrible. Like it was just the whole time I was kind of bored and I was irritated and I was agitated. The word that kept coming up was blah. You know, my therapist, who was amazing, was like, well, what's it like to just be with blah?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, well, what's it like to be with blah? And then, you know, the session ended and it was just like this total disappointment. And I felt like I did something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I remember my therapist turning to me and saying, you know, these are actually the most interesting, the most powerful journeys in some ways, because you get to see how your mind works and you get to sort of experience the full range of emotions, because the mind doesn't just go to these places of happiness and bliss. It goes to places of blah a lot. And so, you know, that was one of those moments where I could really see like the power of some of these psychedelic experiences is not just like their ability to take us to catharsis and bliss and really high states, but their ability to acquaint us with the boredom and the blah and the fear and, you know, all these things that we really try to push away. So anyway.
Yes. Yes. And I want to highlight that you say something so important that everybody needs to hear this. And even my clients might be listening, because I do packages of ketamine assisted therapy sessions. Yeah. And there's always one session that they hit up against their bored part, or they didn't go into outer space, and they didn't have all the sparkly, you know, kingship, queenship feelings. And yet in our integration session, they realize how much they've been suppressing that, or they've been, disconnecting from these parts, or they use strategies, unhealthy strategies to, you know, exile those parts of them out of their lives, versus getting to know that this part is afraid of abandonment, or there's something underneath this as a fear of stability and survival. And they don't get that until we, in the integration process, where we sit with these parts and we talk to them and we extract that. And then it transforms them to realize, oh, all of these parts in my life are actually really important. How can I develop relationships with them?
I think that's such a great point. And it's worth also highlighting how countercultural that idea is. You know, like if you go on Instagram, which I was doing this morning.
Same.
It is just an endless stream of what I like to call happy land. So it's actually a chapter in the book, but the idea of happy land is this idea of like, you know, if you just take the right supplements and you follow the right influencers and you do the right, you know, core work each morning and you intermittent fast and you do all these things that, you know, we hear about that are really important to do, that you're going to just feel amazing all the time. You know, your body's going to be amazing. You're going to be super hot and attractive and you're going to lose weight and all these things. And that feels like it generates this momentum in our minds toward the experience of always favoring what feels good, always favoring the comfortable, the pleasurable, which I think goes a long way to explaining why we're glued to our phones all the time, because it is this really easy pathway to pleasure. But what you're saying is just the opposite of that it's actually okay to feel some of these things that don't feel good, to feel uncomfortable and to just like stay in that. So like, this is a really radical idea. It's a radical practice. It goes against most of what we see and hear these days.
Which is why it's so vulnerable to start down this path, right? Of becoming more open. Yeah. And another thing, and I loved that you brought in your therapist in there in your book, because there's also so much beauty in having the support and the container of someone holding this for you, you know, holding you in this experience. And where that's very different than just going to a ketamine clinic or getting infusions or doing psychedelics on your own, or even jumping into that practice by yourself, because there's chaos that can happen. And then how do we make sense of that? And how do we hold ourselves? And how do we not get overwhelmed with the emotions? And I think that's one thing that people are protecting themselves from, is like, what if I feel my emotions and then I'm overwhelmed and then I'm a puddle on the floor? Nobody's here to pick me up.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I am convinced that had I not done this with that intentional structure, therapist, the integration sessions, all of that, I wouldn't have had anywhere near the kinds of experiences that I did. I mean, just one example, I had this experience in one of my sessions where I was going to take a flight a couple of days later to LA, actually. And I've had a fear of flying for about 20 years. So there was something in the back of my consciousness around like, oh, I'm about to get on an airplane, this kind of anxiety. And I didn't walk in thinking like, oh, I'm going to work on my flight anxiety today, but put on the eye mask, headphones. And all of a sudden it was like, I was on plane, you know, not a real plane, but in my mind, it felt like a real plane. And I'm flying and everything feels the same except for one thing, which is that none of the ordinary anxiety and fear and trauma loops, none of that stuff is there. It's just like, I'm having this experience of being on an airplane and I'm like in love with airplanes. Like I want to live on this airplane if I could. And then the craziest thing that happens is all of a sudden, like the mood darkens and the plane's nose diving toward the earth. And I watch the plane explode in a fireball. I watch myself be incinerated by this crash, like basically the manifestation of my worst fear. And it was just beautiful. Like I think I shouted out to my therapist, like it's God, you know, God is a plane crash. It's all so beautiful. Which I know sounds like some crazy drug trip story, but what's not crazy is that, and this happened 2 years ago almost, it completely changed my experience of flying. Not that the anxiety went away. I would still sometimes get anxiety, but what would happen in my mind is the mental loop would go to that moment of what I call being on the ketamine express instead of the usual patterned sort of trauma thinking. And I also had had all these like every week I would have a dream about like being in a plane crash or something like that. The dreams just stopped. And so like that was life changing. But I also feel pretty convinced that without having the context of therapy, both before and after those sessions, I don't think I would have had access to that. Or I wouldn't have known even what to do with that.
Yeah.
So I think it's such an important point you bring up.
Yeah. And in your book, you called it memory consolidation with the memories and the emotions.
Yeah. I mean, I ended up interviewing John Crystal, who's the chair of psychiatry at Yale University. And John is really interesting because he was the one in the 1990s who ran the first studies on the antidepressant effects of ketamine.
In the U.S.
In the U.S. In the U.S. So there were other ones. Okay.
There's another story I'm happy to share with it, but go on.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. But anyway, what he said, which I thought was really interesting, is that according to his research, when ketamine is in the brain, so during the acute effects, basically what's happening is it's inhibiting the NMDA receptors of the brain, which is in the acute phase, basically changing the brain such that the usual associations between like a memory and an emotion just aren't there, right? There's kind of an organic process of neuroplasticity that happens that's blocked during the acute phase of ketamine. So that's happening. And then in the aftermath, like once the drug actually leaves the brain, you have this window of a couple of weeks where there's enhanced neuroplasticity. So according to his explanation, basically what was happening is that I had this organic process of neuroplasticity that would happen every time I would think of being on a plane, where that would then sort of tighten the bond between that association and fear. And ketamine was able to essentially disentangle those and allow me to approach this part of my thinking, part of my psyche, that I really had no other way of getting to or approaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a recoupling process that's happening with these memories and these, right, these associations, and it's helping you to process. So this is why I see ketamine work so well with trauma therapy or looping processes that happen, because when in MDMA is similar, it increases the threshold of what we can tolerate. So we can literally go back into these memories, or like you said, this plane crashing, and not dysregulate. So we can process when we're not dysregulated, but when we dysregulate, we can't process anymore. You know, that's what trauma is. It's an inability to process these memories and these somatic experiences. So just like you said, you could go into it and it would be okay. And there's, you know, and that's giving you a new reference point for it's okay. These experiences are okay. And that's what's, I just love the power of these medicines to be able to create that neural path for us.
Yeah. And I would say that for me, in my experience, there are some psychic scars that I think are almost impossible to approach in that way without a compound like ketamine. So flying as an example, I am a pretty experienced meditator. I've been meditating for 15 years. I would literally meditate for like 30 minutes on takeoff and landing every time I flew. So I must have done that 100 times, maybe 200 times. I don't even know, right? And it really didn't change the experience. Like there was a way in which I couldn't quite approach the experience fully or have the experience in such a way that those associations weren't just automatic and almost overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so I started to see that for people who have these really deep areas of closure in their mind, and this is a really novel and powerful tool that may be the only way of accessing some of these states and learning how to open to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or like a fuck ton of trauma therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe you get there through that too. I didn't try that, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen a drastic reduction of the number of sessions with people with severe CPTSD clients I've seen for years, then start to do the ketamine work in conjunction with therapy, and things rapidly change, like things that we hadn't seen, you know, we had seen in titration, but things rapidly change. But I think the key point here too is to then, what are you doing to integrate this or to continue staying open? And that leads me to ask you, are there practices people can do consistently to maintain this openness? So say they reach this experience, and now how do they make a lifestyle out of that?
I love that question. And I think you and I both know that these psychedelic experiences can be amazing. Mm-hmm. But for me anyway, the next day I wake up and I have to take the garbage out to the curb, you know, and take my kid to school.
Yeah.
I live in a very unpsychedelic life, you know, 8 hours or 4 hours or whatever afterwards. Right. So I think that integration question is key. Mm-hmm. Meditation, I have found to be an incredible practice. And particularly there's a strand of meditation practice that I would call open awareness meditation, where the whole goal is basically, instead of like cultivating really intense, deep focus or concentration, the goal is more expanding the size of the mind and awareness. Mm-hmm. So those practices, Dzogchen, Mahamudra, things like that, I think can be great. Mm-hmm. The other practice that is probably one of my favorites, and I think really powerful for people for whom meditation is kind of a non-starter, I call it street opening. And it's basically just this idea of bringing a kind of awareness meditation-like practice with us into the absolute shitstorm that is ordinary life. Mm-hmm. So like in the book, You know, I talk about spending a day at my local Costco, trying to turn that into an ashram, you know, by meditating in the furniture section and the pharmacy and things like that. And that's an extreme example, but I have just found that it's really like this incredible practice to use these settings of everyday life, which are often really uncomfortable, annoying, boring. You know, you just think about like an average day, you're stuck in traffic, you're like standing in line at the store and somebody in front of you in the express line has 20 items and it's a 10 item, you know, limit or whatever it is. Turning all of those moments into opportunities to practice that shift, you know, and even just like standing in a grocery store, instead of pulling out your phone, allowing yourself to just see the whole scene in panoramic awareness and listen to the sounds, that subtle shift in consciousness or awareness can be so powerful and can give you like a little microdose of that kind of psychedelic insight, you know, but in the midst of everyday life and can start to become a kind of practice or habit.
Yeah, it's like the lost art of people watching. Which is actually one of my favorite games to play. Yeah, that's really cool. Actually, as I think about that too, adding playfulness to that can probably help us to stay present to the experience too. Like I used to play this game where, you know, I'd see people just out and about and I'd make up conversations that they would be having. And if I was with somebody, I'd be like, you know, Doris is saying this to so-and-so and he's having this response back and just having fun with the environment, you know, versus, you know, going into a screen or going into something that's outside of the environment.
Yeah. And I think that's like something that we may be losing as a society. Cause I grew up, I was a teenager in the 90s, you know? And so when I think back to those moments, I spent a lot of time just kind of like sitting there waiting for the bus and I didn't have a phone. So it would just be observing what was happening or to your point, making up random conversations or even, you know, just like allowing my thoughts to settle and listen to the deeper wisdom of my mind that I think like we've kind of lost that practice. And so, you know, simply giving yourself a break every now and then from the phone, you know, not to say like never check it, but maybe only check it 50% of the time. And the other 50% of the time, just like see what's happening in your mind, what's happening around you. That in itself is a really powerful practice of opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Circling this back to relationships, like how do you see, you know, this openness versus closeness? How do you see this? And because you wrote that book, 80 Marriage. Yeah. How do you see this impacting relationships?
Oh, man, so much. I mean, so for that book, we interviewed about 100 people about their marriage. We wanted to really understand the state of modern relationships.
Sure.
And I would say the number one complaint that came up was about digital distraction. So the story we would hear again and again is some version of I'm with my spouse, it's before bed, and we're both sitting on opposite sides of the bed. I've got my tablet, my spouse has their phone, we're scrolling Instagram or whatever, doom scrolling the news. And that there's a way in which a lot of couples are just getting locked into these patterns of distraction. And connecting a lot with their phones, but not really connecting a lot with each other.
Yeah.
The other really interesting stat that I think kind of blew my mind, John Gottman talks a lot about this, that they did some research at UCLA and found couples with kids spend on average about 35 minutes a week connecting with each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is like, what, 5 minutes a day? Mm-hmm. That's crazy, right? So I think that there is this kind of closure that's happening in relationships. Mm-hmm. And so just to be able to take a step back as a couple and ask questions like, hey, you know, are we setting aside intentional time free from our devices where we can connect? Mm-hmm. That's a huge move. I think even like the meta move there of what we saw is that a lot of couples are sort of doing relationship by accident. So, you know, we're just going to let random historical accident, gender norms from the 1950s define our relationship. instead of the move there is like doing relationship more intentionally, having conversations like what's working, what's not working, how can we restructure things? That kind of practice can be hugely valuable for couples.
I agree. And I think, you know, there you may come up against conflict or disagreement. And if we don't have the skills to be able to navigate conversations like that, then yeah, it makes sense why we would want to just go to our screens and our Instagrams to avoid that, you know, the discomfort that requires of asking questions of ourselves and partners.
Yeah. Well, and then on top of this, as you know, there's all this talk now about the sexual recession, or yes, even I've heard it called the sexual Great Depression.
Oh, and interesting.
Yeah, it's super interesting, right? Like you look at the statistics on how many times the average couple has sex, and right around 2007, when the smartphone is introduced, these numbers start to just plummet. And I think that's super interesting. Like, I don't know what the causal connection is there. Can we blame it all on social media and smartphone? Maybe not, but whatever's happening, it seems like the trend line is moving toward both disconnection emotionally, but also we're not having sex as much, which is bizarre to me because like, this is probably the most pleasurable thing available to human beings. And yet we'd rather be on Instagram. Mm-hmm. That's interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, sex is vulnerable. Sex requires us to be in our bodies. And if that's an uncomfortable place to be, or we don't know how to self-regulate, or if we don't know how to have vulnerable conversations, like, yeah, it's going to be shitty sex. It might not be pleasant.
Totally. Well, we like to say, I'm sure you believe this as well, that like what happens in the bedroom is just a mirror of what happens in the rest of your life. So, you know, we like to think of sex as like this disconnected realm from everything else. But like really what's happening in line at Costco is what's happening in the bedroom. So if you're experiencing a relationship where you really are kind of like checking out from each other and on your devices all the time and trying to like avoid each other, then that's exactly what's going to happen in the bedroom. Like, like it's no coincidence that those two are going to match.
We see a lot of that overlap and patterns of dissociation or patterns of trying to regulate through our partner by sex and putting unconsciously putting pressure on our partner. We don't realize it. We don't mean it, but we're like, I'm dysregulated. I'm anxious. Let's have sex. And then, you know, and then the other person not being able to vocalize what they need or speak up. And you're absolutely right. We see so much overlap of these patterns here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So being able to practice a sense of openness and being able to not only open ourselves to our own concepts, but to hold space for the possibly differing opinion of our partner can really help us.
Yeah. I mean, I think in any relationship, communication is key, but it's not just talking about things. It's like, how are we talking about things? Mm-hmm. And I like to say that your partner mirrors your mindset. Mm. So if you come into a conversation with a really closed mindset where you're feeling a lot of resentment or there's a lot of blame, your partner instinctively knows to mirror that back to you. Like that's just the physics of it, you know? And so I think this is the power of something like this move to openness is that if you can approach a conversation that may be difficult with your partner with a more open perspective, with a more expansive mind, your partner may not even know it, but in some way they're gonna feel that. They're gonna mirror that back. Like it's gonna be a more collaborative, curious conversation than the typical way in which we do drama in relationships, which is, you know, a lot of blame, a lot of victim stuff, a lot of like finger pointing.
Yeah.
Which just creates these cycles that are impossible to get out of.
Yeah, I think yes and, right? And I only say that because I tend to work with a lot of trauma and people coming out of abusive relationships where they overrid their own opinions to make it safe in the relationship. Well, if I just go along with what they're saying, or if I give all my power and put this person on a pedestal, then we can live harmoniously, right? So it's like, yes, I think a majority can have this mirror effect. I really, really believe in that. And there is subpopulation that it doesn't matter how much you try, how much you effort, how much you, it's, you're not going to be able to change that person or get that person to be in that open space.
Yeah. And I love that you brought that up, because one of the interesting things I found on this journey is that openness is a good thing, but there is such a thing as too much of a good thing.
Ooh, right? Tell us. Okay, go on.
So what I mean by that is your example about a relationship where somebody is consistently subsuming their own needs for their partner, not saying what they really want in some sort of trauma pattern like that.
Yeah.
A stance of just like, hey, I want to be really open to my partner is not going to be very skillful for them, because what they really need is to set some boundaries. And I think that holds true of openness across the board, that, you know, if we're just trying to be super open, you could imagine going too far with that. Like basically saying like, I'm not going to have any boundaries. I'm not going to lock my car. I'm not going to like, you know, lock my house at night because I'm open, you know, like I'm just going to let the world walk all over me. And that is not at all what the game that I want to play anyway. I think like a more skillful version of openness is to say, yeah, I want to have this experience, particularly with respect to my own mind, mm-hmm. of being a little bit more open to everything that's happening. But I also want to be able to set clear boundaries with my mm-hmm. partner, with the world. And I call that skillful closing, which I think is just a really important thing to remember, that, you know, for an alcoholic, for example, it's not skillful to be open to friends who are still drinking and trying to get them to drink. Like that is just not a good idea. That's an area where skillful closing might be the better thing to do. So I think it is important to raise that issue, because like these distinctions are important.
Yeah, it's like our sense of self. Like we can have an opinion, we can have our experience and our truth, and that can be different than somebody. But if we just are so open, we don't have a sense of self. It's everybody, what everybody else tells us is right and true. And
exactly,
I see that sometimes in the sex positivity world. Or if I have couples coming in, I work a lot with people who want to go to play parties or swinger world or, you know, that kind of thing. And where one partner will override their own internal boundaries or needs in order to be this quote unquote open sex positive image of what they think that being that person is supposed to be. And it ends up causing a lot of challenge there, because, or even somatic pains and chronic pain too, because they're not allowing themselves permission to have a sense of self there.
Yeah.
And let my boundaries be okay. And it doesn't mean I'm not sex positive or open. It just means I'm honoring what's true for me.
Yeah. So I think, you know, my background is a philosophy professor.
Yeah.
Aristotle actually has this great way of expressing this.
Yeah.
Where he talks about virtue as being the mean or the middle point between excess and deficiency. So too little of something or too much of something. And I think generally we're living in a time where we have an excess of closure happening. Mm. So the whole point of this project is to say like, hey, it's really interesting if we experiment with like opening a little bit more. Maybe that'll get us back to that mean point. But as you say, some people, for whatever reason, they're already experiencing almost like excess openness. And for them, the opposite practice might be more skillful, to see what happens when they close a little bit more, when they distract themselves a little more, when they set more boundaries. And Aristotle had this great idea, which is like, if you find yourself really stuck in excess or deficiency, you overshoot the mean as a way of coming back into balance.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're talking about here. Most of us are really closing down in significant ways. So overshooting the mean in the direction of openness can mm-hmm. bring us back into balance. But there's also the risk of getting stuck in the excess of openness, which we don't want either.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a difference between being rigid and saying no.
Yeah, totally.
that no is actually really important too.
It's yeah, even at the beginning of this conversation, you asked me like, do you have any boundaries around what you want to talk about? And I was like, yeah, I do have one boundary. I'm not going to talk about details of my sex life. And, but that was just a way of us like really like creating the framework of the conversation such that it was totally easeful after that. And I didn't even think about it after that. It was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I could hold that line. Yeah. And I think that's also important too, for us to see how trust is built when somebody can hold our requests of no and let that be okay and not mean something about you being rigid or prudish or non-compliant, but totally. Yeah, this is part of developing relationships.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah. And coming back to the part where you're talking about psychedelics, how psychedelics can be opening, you know, being careful that we're not using psychedelics to override our no in order to be that open person, that it's like it's a dance. It's a relationship with these substances too.
Yeah. Well, and that's where I think having somebody like you who can help the person who's doing these sessions find that balance, because I think for all of us, like, it's very difficult to see our own blind spots.
Totally.
It's very difficult to see when we are out of balance sometimes, and we need help. We need support. I mean, you know, that's just part of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We don't have to do this by ourselves. we don't have to go into the dark recesses of our mind by ourselves to figure it out.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I coach people, but I make sure that I'm coached, because I know that I can't be a really effective coach if I'm walking around in the world with all these like weird patterns that I'm not seeing. And, you know, that's not going to help anyone. I'm just creating more suffering. So
me too. I have my own therapist. We work on my own projections. It's great.
Totally. That's awesome. I love that.
Nate, this was such a great conversation. You're so lively and so profound with your information. Where can people find you? Where can they get your books?
Yeah. So the new book Open is available wherever you buy books, local bookstores, Amazon, et cetera. My website's probably the best place to come to, nateklemp.com. We have a newsletter my wife and I write that goes out every couple of weeks that has tips on relationships, tips on living a more skillful life, things like that. So those are the best places to find me. Instagram as well. I'm out there.
Yeah. And minimize your screening.
Yeah, I try not to be out there too much, but you know, it's part of the gig. If you're writing books, you gotta be on Instagram.
It's so true. Well, this was fun. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Kat.
Well, that was fun. Thanks for tuning in, lovers. And if you want to experience more ecstasy and sexual liberation, head over to sexlovepsychedelics.com and learn about how you can join me for any one of my online or live events. And while you're there, grab my free guide on sex and psychedelics. Remember, this podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Please contact your healthcare provider and local law before pursuing any of the products or psychedelics discussed. And one final note here. I make this show specifically for you. If you're loving the show, then be sure to leave me a review in iTunes or Spotify to let me know. Happy to be here and happy to serve. I'll see you next time on Sex, Love, Psychedelics.